Hello and welcome to the fourth episode in the series of Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams, on Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. In a slight adjustment to the schedule, I am postponing the programme about Ireland and going to continue with last week's series on thinkers. So some of the same voices will reappear because I didn't feel like I had enough of Buckminster Fuller, for example. I'm going to let the side of the record play out that I had to cut short of him. There was a little taster of Marshall McLuhan at the end of last week's show. I'm going to have another good long chunk of McLuhan, which has some music in it as well, but it's a multimedia extravaganza, I guess you'd call it. So that's going to be quite a long chunk. We also have some different sorts of thinkers as well. There's going to be some Aldous Huxley, and he's a favourite of mine, and then some various other odds and ends that crop up at various points. So without further ado, back to Marshall McLuhan.
How do you like it so far?
This last week was like a total breakdown.
I wouldn't be seen dead with a living work of art.
Nowadays, a fact is what has been translated into words of images. Those qualities, these forms to combine facts abstractly upon opinion, public place is wit.
Drop this jiggery pokery and talk straight turkey. The word is out.
What did I say?
I'm not too often scared about this. It's just a thing.
Yeah, how about that?
There'll probably be some music, but we'll manage to find a quiet corner where we can talk.
Professor McLuhan is...
Our time is a time for crossing barriers, for erasing old categories, for probing around. When two seemingly disparate elements are imaginatively posed, put in apposition in new and unique ways, startling discoveries often result. Medium of our time, electric circuitry, profoundly involves men with one another. Information pours instantaneously and continuously. As soon as information is acquired, it is very rapidly replaced by still newer information. Our electrically configured world has forced us to move from the habit of data classification to the mode of pattern recognition, block by block. We can no longer build serially, block by block, step by step, because instant communication ensures that all factors of the environment and of experience coexist in a state of active interest.
There ain't no grammatical errors in a non-literate society.
All media work us over completely. They are so pervasive in their
personal,
political,
economic,
aesthetic,
psychological,
moral,
ethical,
and social consequences that they leave no part of us untouched, unaffected, unaltered. The medium is the massage.
The medium is the massage.
Any understanding of social and cultural change is impossible without a knowledge of the way media work as environments.
Everything we do is music.
McLuhan will be doing once he's there next week or later this year.
There's a friend of mine at Fordham who's on the faculty, and
to do until McLuhan comes. Yeah. Right. Nice.
We can't the French make a distinction.
I believe it. I really believe it.
For another program.
That incredible to think about, right? Yeah. Because he's a very unlikely hero in many ways.
Until writing was invented, man lived in acoustic space. Boundless, directionless, horizonless, in the dark of the mind, in the world of emotion, by primordial intuition, by terror. Speech is a social chart of this bog.
The wrath of Achilles is my fear. That fatal wrath which in fulfillment of the will of Zeus brought the Achaeans so much suffering and sent gallant souls of many noblemen to Hades, leaving their bodies as carrion for the dogs and passing birds. Let us begin, goddess of song, with the angry parting that took place between Agamemnon, king of men, and the great Achilles, son of Peleus.
Which of the gods was it that made them quarrel?
Structures and overall patterns in the world easy to see.
The discovery of the alphabet will create.
I believe it. I really believe it.
The goose quill put an end to talk. It abolished mystery. It gave architecture and towns. It brought roads and armies, bureaucracy. It was the basic metaphor with which the cycle of civilization began. The step from the dark into the light of the mind. The hand that filled the parchment page built a city.
We shape our tools, and thereafter our tools, epos.
Whence did the wondrous mystic art arise? Of painting speech and speaking to the eyes. That we, by tracing magic lines, are taught how to embody and to color thought.
Writing did not merely record language. It was a totally new medium of expression and communication which the spoken word came in turn to imitate. Writing encouraged an analytical mode of thinking, with emphasis upon lineality.
Once more, please.
The trouble is I keep thinking of improvements on these passages all the time. With emphasis upon lineality, continuity, and connectedness. In other words, visuality.
Where is A? It precedes B. And B follows A and precedes C.
Writing was an embalming process that froze language. It eliminated the art of ambiguity and made puns the lowest form of wit.
Should all Aquinas be forgot?
The expert is the man who stays put.
Soon all that will be required of us will be 1 hour's work a year.
Writing destroyed word linkages. The simultaneous interrelation between many levels of meaning of the word have to be sacrificed to keeping everything moving on a single plane, on one level. The word became the static symbol, applicable to and separate from that which is symbolized. It now belonged to the objective world. It could be seen. It was a thing. Now came the distinction between being and meaning.
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
We don't know what we think until a question is put to us.
Says that all he's doing is describing, not...
John? John who?
Doesn't make very many value judgments or suggestions about what people should do about these things.
Show me something.
For instance,
new.
Marshall himself says that
again.
All he's doing is describing, not prescribing.
Every new technology creates a new environment in which men live and work. The technology of the alphabet and of movable type printing, 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 predisposed us to think and act in certain ways. Printing extended the emphasis upon lineality. It fostered and encouraged a fragmenting process, a process of specialism and of detachment, a habit of thinking in bits and parts, and step by step. Printing completely changed everything. It changed what men thought of themselves, how they behaved toward each other. It changed systems of government, and so on, and so on, and so on.
And so on, and so on, and so on.
You know, the most favorable moment to seize a man and influence him is when he's alone in the mass.
Printing technology confirmed and extended the new visual stress. It provided the first uniformly repeatable commodity, the first assembly line, mass production. It created the portable book, which men could read in privacy and in isolation from others. Man could now inspire and conspire. It was the print-oriented genius of the Western world that created an applied knowledge and technology unrivaled in human history and learned to manipulate matter, energy, and human life by breaking down every useful process into its functional parts, then producing any required number of each part.
You're feeling like you was lost in the bush, boy?
Just as pre-shaped parts became components of, say, an airplane, human specialists became components of a great social machine.
Compartmentalization of occupation. Compartmentalization of occupations and interests bring about. Compartmentalization of occupations and interests bring about a separation of that mode of activity.
So that's clocking it at $40,000 a year. Coming up to Marshall with a copy of the book in their hand, asking for an autograph with absolutely the same degree of abandon and awe that they would go to Willie Mays.
The Balinese have a saying: we have no art. We do everything as well as we can. As we move into the world of integral, computerized knowledge...
Brother Wright, lovely the master's meeting grounds where 1963...
Mere classification becomes secondary and inadequate.
Each of these
Mere classification becomes secondary and inadequate to the speeds with which data can now be processed. We are moving out of the world of data classification into the world of pattern recognition.
The highest purpose is to have no purpose at all. This puts one in accord with nature
and her manner of operation.
Why did the moron take a ladder to church?
Like easel painting, the printed book added much to the cult of the individual. The private fixed point of view became possible. Literacy conferred the power of detachment, of non-involvement. There's a story which illustrates the
conversations are brilliant, exciting, stimulating.
A kind of pun is not customary in literary society.
David Ogilvy, the advertiser.
The story of the Boy Scout who helped a nun across the street.
Tends to begin all his memos with...
And the nun thanked the lad, who replied... That's all right, madam. Any relative of Batman's a friend of mine. The visual pattern of the sculptured costume, starched costume of the nun, bears a certain structural relation to Batman's costume, so that the strange bridge between the nun and Batman is a bit of pattern recognition or visual punning. Visual punning, as opposed to mere verbal punning, is something that is beginning to happen again in our electronic time, and it is one of the pet activities of Eskimos. They delight in spotting visual puns in the ordinary environment in various materials.
Such as?
Stone. They delight to see a configuration in a stone that resembles a walrus tusk or a...
Do you like your job, Professor McLuhan?
America was able to develop and apply swiftly all the consequences of printing. In the book, the newspaper, and by extension the assembly line in industry and organization and markets, because there was no backlog of obsolete technology to be liquidated first. Europeans had to struggle through a long, painful period in order to clear enough room to exploit the new print technology.
Quanto è bella la prospettiva.
Okay, now once more with more expression, Irving.
Quanto è bella la prospettiva.
Now hold it. That's part of the script.
Our Renaissance legacy was the vanishing point, the single static viewpoint of the limited optical science of the time. This single piercing view demanded a central point of interest and an undisturbed, restful symmetry to either side of it.
This is the place to see it from, Phyllis.
Good.
The eye, it cannot choose but see. We cannot bid the ear be still. Our bodies feel where'er they be, against or with our will.
Those who write the anatomy of experience...
The alphabet is an aggressive and militant absorber and transformer of culture.
The positions in here...
The alphabet is an aggressive and militant absorber and transformer of culture. The alphabet is an aggressive and militant absorber and transformer of cultures.
I've never been here before.
Now for the evidence, said the king, and then the sentence. Now, said the queen, first the sentence and then the evidence. Nonsense, cried Alice so loudly that everybody jumped. The idea of having the sentence first.
The alphabet is a construct of fragmented bits and parts which have no semantic meaning in themselves. Must be strung together in a line, bead-like, and in a prescribed order. Its use fostered and encouraged the habit of perceiving all environment in visual and spatial terms, particularly in terms of a space and of a time that are human thought continuous and compared. The line, that good old reliable continuum, became the organizing principle of life.
Advanced systems of so-called typesetting really get going, then I think that it would be very, very simple to, and inexpensive, and quite reasonable to simply record conversation.
Yeah. We habitually say, I don't follow you.
Chopping and groping. Yeah.
The new principle, how does that grab you, is a more involved, multi-sensuous approach to the problem of meaning.
As we begin, so shall we go.
Rationality and logic came to depend on the presentation of connected and sequential facts or concepts. For many people, rationality still has the connotation of uniformity and connectedness. I don't follow you means I don't think what you're saying is rational. How does that grab you?
I still don't follow you.
Indeed, even our tests for sanity often assume that the line is present in nature and must be discovered or given visual existence.
Typography crank, the voices of silence.
Take it easy, but take it.
What has been worked over to give it a general character very, very few people can experience directly.
We are proud of our museums, where we display a way of living that we have made impossible.
The railway radically altered the personal outlooks and patterns of social interdependence. It bred and nurtured the American dream. It created totally new urban, social, and family worlds, new ways of work, new ways of management, new legislation. As the new electric technologies come into play, people are less and less convinced of the importance of self-expression. Teamwork succeeds private effort. Ours is the first age in which many thousands of the best trained minds have made it a full-time business to get inside the collective public mind. To get inside in order to manipulate, exploit, control.
The art of the speaker consists in compressing all of his aims into slogans.
Then thereafter, our tools shape us.
What'll happen when intelligence is recognized as a global resource?
That was Marshall McLuhan together with Jerome Agel and Quentin Fiore in a record entitled The Medium is the Massage. And that's not a spelling mistake. Lots of quotes and sort of references to Joyce and Finnegan's Wake and playing with language. And I'm afraid that's about the closest we're going to get to the scheduled program on Ireland. But we will come back to that at a later date and present some Finnegan's Wake and various other things in the fullness of time. Now, I must just point out that there'll be lots of clicks and pops, and you might get some surface noise and other sorts of evidence of the records themselves. And, you know, I guess I could go through each record and try and eliminate every pop and crackle and that sort of thing. But actually, I feel that lots of these noises, incidental noises, are kind of part of the pleasure of listening to these recordings. It's like an embodied listening history in the actual record itself. So please forgive the pops and crackles and clicks, but that's just part of listening to records. And occasionally I might try and get rid of some of the really horrendous ones, but mostly they're just all in there. It's just part of the enjoyment. So we'll move on to maybe a slightly less complicated thinker. And this is mediated by the voice of Alan Bennett.
One fine winter's day, when Piglet was brushing away the snow in front of his house, he happened to look up, and there was Winnie the Pooh. Pooh was walking round and round in a circle, thinking of something else, and when Piglet called to him, he just went on walking.
"Hello," said Piglet. "What are you doing?"
"Hunting," said Pooh.
"Hunting what?"
"Tracking something," said Winnie the Pooh very mysteriously.
"Tracking what?"
said Piglet, coming closer. "That's just what I ask myself. I ask myself what."
"What do you think you'll answer?"
"I shall have to wait until I catch up with it," said Winnie the Pooh. "Now look there." He pointed to the ground in front of him. "What do you see there?"
"Tracks,"
said Piglet.
"Paw marks."
He gave a little squeak of excitement.
"Pooh, do you think it's a woozle?"
"It may be," said Pooh. "Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. You never can tell with paw marks." With these few words he went on tracking, and Piglet, after watching him for a minute or two, ran after him. Winnie the Pooh had come to a sudden stop, and was bending over the tracks in a puzzled sort of way.
"What's the matter?"
asked Piglet. "It's a very funny thing," said Bear, "but there seem to be two animals now. This, whatever it was, has been joined by another, whatever it is, and the two of them are now proceeding in company. Would you mind coming with me, Piglet, in case they turn out to be hostile animals?" Piglet scratched his ear in a nice sort of way, and said that he'd nothing to do until Friday, and would be delighted to come, in case it really was a woozle. "You mean in case it really is two woozles?" said Winnie the Pooh. So off they went together. There was a small spinney of larch trees just here, and it seemed as if the two woozles, if that is what they were, had been going round this spinney, so round this spinney went Pooh and Piglet after them, Piglet passing the time by telling Pooh how his grandfather had suffered in his later years from shortness of breath and other matters of interest, and Pooh wondering if perhaps this was two grandfathers they were after now. And still the tracks went on in front of them. Suddenly Winnie the Pooh stopped and pointed excitedly in front of him.
"Look!"
"Ooh, ooh."
"What?"
said Piglet with a jump. And then to show that he hadn't been frightened, he jumped up and down once or twice more in an exercising sort of way.
"The tracks," said Pooh. "A third animal has joined the other two."
"Pooh!" cried Piglet.
"Do you think it's another woozle?"
"No," said Pooh, "because it makes different marks. It's either two woozles and one, as it might be, whizzle, or two, as it might be, whizzles, and one, if so it is, woozle."
So they went on, feeling just a little anxious now, in case the three animals in front of them were of hostile intent. And Piglet wished very much that his grandfather were there, instead of elsewhere, and Pooh thought how nice it would be if they met Christopher Robin suddenly, but quite accidentally, and only because he liked Christopher Robin so much. And then, all of a sudden, Winnie the Pooh stopped again. There were four animals in front of them. "Do you see, Piglet? Look at their tracks. Three, as it were, woozles, and one, as it was, whizzle. Another woozle has joined them." And so it seemed to be. There were the tracks, crossing over each other here, getting muddled up with each other there, but quite plainly, every now and then, the tracks of four sets of paws.
I think, said Piglet, that I just remembered something I forgot to do yesterday and shan't be able to do tomorrow. So I suppose I really ought to go back and do it now.
We'll do it this afternoon, and I'll come with you, said Pooh.
But, oh, it isn't the sort of thing you can do in the afternoon. It's a very particular morning thing. It has to be done in the morning. So, really, dear old Pooh, if you'll excuse me. What's that?
Pooh looked up at the sky, and then, as he heard the whistle again, he looked up into the branches of a big oak tree, and then he saw a friend of his. It's Christopher Robin, he said.
Oh, you'll be all right, said Piglet. You'll be quite safe with him. Goodbye.
And he trotted off home as quickly as he could. Christopher Robin came slowly down his tree. Silly old bear, he said. What were you doing? First you went round the spinney twice by yourself, and then Piglet ran after you, and you went round again together, and then you were just going round a fourth time. Wait a moment, said Winnie the Pooh, holding up his paw. He sat down and thought in the most thoughtful way he could think. Then he fitted his paw into one of the tracks, and he scratched his nose twice and stood up. Yes, said Winnie the Pooh. I see now, said Winnie the Pooh. I have been foolish and deluded, said he, and I am a bear of no brain at all. You're the best bear in all the world, said Christopher Robin soothingly. Am I? Said Pooh hopefully, and then he brightened up suddenly. Anyhow, he said, it's nearly luncheon time. So he set off home for it.
There's the voice of Alan Bennett reading Winnie the Pooh. Also on the same record, there's a number of other stories, but one of my favourites is Eeyore's birthday. I think the combination of the accent and the subject matter is what is a match made in heaven. And if I get a chance, I'll play that story at a later date. So moving on, in these troubled times, there's a poem called Money by Milton, read by, I can't remember. I'll have to check and let you know after the record.
When I had money, money, oh, I knew no joy till I went poor, for many a false man as a friend came knocking all day at my door. Then felt I like a child that holds a trumpet that he must not blow because a man is dead. I dared not speak to let this false world know. Much have I thought of life and seen how poor men's hearts are ever light, and how their wives do hum like bees about their work from morn till night. So when I hear these poor ones laugh and see the rich ones coldly frown, poor men, think I, need not go up so much as rich men should come down. When I had money, money, oh, my many friends proved all untrue. But now I have no money, oh, my friends are real, though very few.
Well, I made a pig's ear of the introduction to that. I was looking at the wrong side. That was, of course, Money by William Henry Davis. And from the sleeve notes of the record, it says, reminder, this is a 33 and a third RPM recording. But more to the point, it says, William Henry Davis was a peddler and tramp until discovery by George Bernard Shaw brought fame and fortune. Then he settled down to write what Shaw delightedly called odds and ends of verse about odds and ends of things. So there we go, odds and ends cropped up about three or four times already in the programme, and we're not quite halfway through. So the next record I'm going to play is the second half of the side of the record in which Buckminster Fuller is talking about tunings, and it has a lovely description of a tree and amongst other things. So I'll just, without further ado, play that and maybe play the whole of the second side at a later date. But for those who weren't listening last week, just it might take a little bit of time to get into the rhythm and the pace of Bucky's voice. But once you do, I'm sure it'll pay dividends.
There's capability to do more with less. Begin to make it very clear that you can take care of everybody, not only take care of them, but take care of them ever and ever higher standard of living. Now it's beginning to be really very evident. We can take care of all the generations to come. And one of the things that is perfectly clear about this is that we find I've plotted curves and kept them very carefully of all the different birth rates in all the different countries around the world. I also keep curves of the rate of electrical energy consumption by each of the different economies. I find as the per capita energy consumption goes up in any country, the curve of the birth rate is exactly the opposite. As energy consumption goes up, birth rate goes exactly down, just strictly reflection pattern of it. We're at a point now where Russia, United States, Japan are all on a negative level. We're not producing more children at all. So I say as we industrialize, we begin to find this technology of learning that know-how, that scaffolding in this life makes it possible then to cut down the birth rate. This is a very fundamental way that nature, when she has important functions to perform in the universe, and the trees have extraordinarily important functions, and the trees then, their function is to impound the sun radiation by photosynthesis, and they have to have roots so they can do it, because otherwise they couldn't expose all that leafage to the great winds. They have to be able to get water out of the ground to hold their shape. They have to have water then to keep them from dehydrating with all that radiation. They have to get water in the sky to rain back on them. So trees have to have roots. Therefore, they can't go out and plant their seed. And the function of their seed is going to be to impound the sun radiation. So they've got to get the seed out from under the shadow in order to function. So we find every tree giving off 100,000 little flying machines, little gliders with beautiful seeds in them, hoping that some of them are going to get out where they'll land in a place that is favorable. So when this is a very important function. When nature has an important function, the chances of survival of the progeny are poor. She then makes many stars. And I'm assuming she needed human beings very, very badly. As the chances of life success go up, down go the birth. Right. Absolute perfect curve. So I could now really say it's coming in evidence that we're not going to be able to take care of all the people alive, but all the people to come. The kind of things I begin to say to you then begin to make something else very clear, because we'd learn more and more about our physical universe. When I was 28, Hubble discovered another galaxy. We now have discovered 2 billion such galaxies. The range of our information is enormous. We're getting to the point where all the mysteries that you could possibly have are implicit in that universe we're discovering. We're getting to the point where you don't need two universes. You don't need an afterlife. And we're getting to where we only one universe will do. I'm also then helping you to break down some other barriers, really. I'm thinking like the life and death run and the tuning in and tuning out. That we're coming into some new kind of relationship to life, which is very, very important. I say that to understand what I'm thinking about, we have to understand a little of the way the universe appears to very different people. Isaac Newton, who thought of things in a very static manner, he thought of time as a quality permeating all universe uniformly. Did not know that light had a speed. He assumed what he called instant universe. When we discover that light has a speed, then you discover, for instance, that the light coming from the sun takes 8 minutes to get to us. If you look at the pole star and you see a live show taking place 460 years ago, it took 460 years for the light to get to us. Look at Andromeda and you're seeing a live show taking place 1 million years ago. Einstein said the universe is quite clearly an aggregate of non-simultaneous events. And each one of these events has a great duration. So the different durations overlap one another. The information may come to you and I, this place, and another part of the universe come quite differently, but there's an overlapping of them. And each one of these events is an energy event. There's some great energy transformation. There's letting go all the radiation which reaches you and I to make it appear as a star. So he said, I said, what Einstein is talking about is what I call scenario universe. Scenario universe, you have many, many episodes. Different characters come in, they overlap other characters. Episodes overlap episodes. So there's a continuity that counts. When you get to scenario universe, then you realize that one frame picture of a caterpillar does not tell you it's going to be a butterfly. And when you get to realizing that a scenario universe is quite different from a single frame concept or inference, it is simply not until you have a number of frames do you understand that it turns into a butterfly, but then it takes many, many frames to really realize the butterfly is flying. And if you ever learn how the butterfly flies, it may take you a billion frames. To get any real meaning out of scenario universe means enormous sections and many information from other people about their episodes that they've observed. You aggregate as much as you can, and as you aggregate more and more, and our ability to write and record is making it possible for us to get a very large number of overlaps of the episodes of scenario universe. And incidentally, a scenario universe, which is overlaps entirely, obviously has no beginning or ending. It has nothing to do with beginning and ending. What we do know about it in a very large way as far as the universe goes, that it no energy gets created, no energy gets lost. Nothing gets lost. So there are times when things are entropic dispersing, and the times when they're syntropic and gathering together. And we have a very beautiful manifesto of that in the fact that our vegetation is impounding the sun radiation by photosynthesis and converting random receipts of sun radiation when the clouds are not in the way and converting them into beautiful, orderly, molecular structures, which is exactly the opposite of entropy, where things become increasingly disorderly. We find all the biological life is syntropic instead of entropic. And our planet Earth is one of the places where energy is being collected and impounded and buried deeply, as for instance, the fossil fuels. All in very orderly molecular condition. So this is typical then of the fact that all the stars we can see are seen because they're entropic. Where energy being exported, you wouldn't get anything being exported to tell you. There'd be no energy coming, so we'd be unaware of that part. But we happen by luck to be on one of the places where energy being imported to tell us that this is exactly what goes on in the invisible spots of our universe. So these are the non-time tuned in, they're not broadcasting, but they will be broadcasting later. Anyway, we have that 100% regenerative universe, but not with any beginning or ending. There's no time. You simply have to take the sum total of all the information, which keeps finding, it keeps always adding up. So it's a very different kind of idea. I find so many of the scientists talking about beginnings and endings, they continually talk about having to find some way to explain a beginning and ending. But most important is to realize all of it is happening in pure principle. The most exciting thing to me, and I will talk about this later, is then the concept of the life being strictly pure principle itself. The principle is so superb. It's simply a very high frequency. The frequency is so high that this thing can't go through. I don't understand that, can't you? I can simply demonstrate to you at any time you want the propeller blades coming out so fast you can't put your finger in between it before it gets around. And so I simply say, this is pure principle. And all of the things that really work in our universe are working in pure principle. They're not physical at all. This is what we'll come to in our next chapter.
It's the voice of Buckminster Fuller. For our next chapter, we're going to keep it kind of slightly cosmic and drop into the world of Lee Perry very briefly, which is there's an intro on the on a Mojo giveaway 7-inch single at the beginning of Kentucky Skank, which is one of his finest records, and it's a little bit of Lee talking in an interview. And it's copyright 1973, but I'm sure the interview and the spoken section is from way past that, presumably post the Black Ark breakdown. Okay, here he is, Lee Perry.
The way you moved all the sounds together and just get one out of the way and bring the next one in and stack them on top of each other.
Another thing about it is, I'd like, in my brain is like a computer, like telling me what to do. Everything that I am doing, I hear what to do. Something is there, clicking, do this. And all the words that I said, I'm hearing it here. Something, some angel is telling me everything, what to do. So it's like, I think it's a program, I had a program here, Master Disc. So you tick-tock until what to do. It's not, I don't even have to think it happened. From the give me the machine and it's there, I can make you maybe 10 million songs in a year. And I'll, different vibration, different melody. Okay, let's take it from here.
And there's the brilliant and wonderful Lee Perry. Moving swiftly on, I'm going to just drop us into some Aldous Huxley, recorded in 1961, talking about alternate forms of religion, funnily enough. Here he is.
You began by making a reputation as a cynical iconoclast. Would you say something about the process that took you to your interest in unorthodox religion?
I was always interested in the descriptions and philosophies of the mystical life. I remember as an undergraduate reading Jacob Boehme and having various Catholic friends who were who knew a certain amount about the mystical tradition in Catholicism. And I read a fair amount at that time. Then I, with sort of mixture of admiration and hostility.
With derision?
Not with derision, but with a good deal of scepticism and with a great deal of fascinated interest. And then I came to read more and meet numbers of people who knew about Oriental material, read a good deal of that, and came in touch with men who'd had first-hand experience. And this interests me very much. I mean, again, this is making the best of both worlds. This utopian fantasy I've just finished is about a society in which, owing to historical accidents, there has been a mingling of Western with Oriental influences, so that both sides are developed and an attempt is made to get the best out of both sides. Many serious philosophers like Northrop, for example, The Meeting of East and West, it's a frightfully dull book, but it's a genuine, serious attempt to make some kind of a synthesis.
But aren't Eastern ideas and presumptions utterly different from ours?
After all, in the past, there have been plenty of syntheses between East and West. I mean, Christianity was one, after all. Neoplatonism certainly got a good deal from the further East, and which became a very important stream in Christianity. I don't think they are utterly different. I mean, did you read a book which I think is a very good book by this Englishman who's lived for many years in Japan and taught there, Blythe, called Zen in English Literature? A very good book. And pointing out, I mean, how much there is in English literature, which is profoundly Zen-like. I mean, Wordsworth is full of Zen, and Whitman is full of Zen. And many, many people have this sort of attitude towards nature. I mean, the Japanese artistic representation of it, both in landscape and in the haiku, is perhaps more refined than anything we did, and more sort of elegant. But nevertheless, it's of the same order, it seems to me. And I mean, in a curious way, I would say that intellectually speaking, the shortest way to India from the West is via Japan and the Far East. Because, I mean, we share with them this kind of nature mysticism which the Indians never developed. And, I mean, the Indians, after all, never developed a landscape art, where the Chinese developed it 1,000 years before we did. And it's possibly the most wonderful religious painting in the world, the great Sung landscapes. So that I don't think there is anything profoundly alien. I mean, this does represent a deliberate attempt to cultivate perception and imagination, to cultivate these non-verbal sides of the total human organism to their highest pitch of refinement and awareness.
Well, I wish I had a better link, really, to introduce the next piece, but I shall just announce what it is, I guess. It's read by Sir Michael Redgrave, who also read the William Henry Davis poem earlier on, and it's Thomas Gray's Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard.
The curfew tolls the knell of parting day. The lowing herd winds slowly o'er the lea. The ploughman homeward plods his weary way and leaves the world to darkness and to me. Now fades the glimmering landscape on the sight, and all the air a solemn stillness holds, save where the beetle wheels his droning flight and drowsy tinklings lull the distant folds. Save that from yonder ivy-mantled tower the moping owl does to the moon complain of such as, wandering near her secret bower, molest her ancient solitary reign. Beneath those rugged elms that yew trees shade, where heaves the turf in many a mouldering heap, each in his narrow cell for ever laid, the rude forefathers of the hamlet sleep. The breezy call of incense-breathing morn, the swallow twittering from the straw-built shed, the cock's shrill clarion, or the echoing horn, no more shall rouse them from their lowly bed. Let not ambition mock their useful toil, their homely joys and destiny obscure, nor grandeur hear with a disdainful smile the short and simple annals of the poor. The boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, awaits alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. Can storied urn or animated bust back to its mansion call the fleeting breath? Can honor's voice provoke the silent dust, or flattery soothe the dull, cold ear of death? Perhaps in this neglected spot is laid some heart once pregnant with celestial fire, hands that the rod of empire might have swayed, or waked to ecstasy the living lyre. Some village Hampton that with dauntless breast the little tyrant of his fields withstood, some mute, inglorious Milton here may rest, some Cromwell, guiltless of his country's blood. The applause of listening senates to command, the threats of pain and ruin to despise, to scatter plenty o'er a smiling land, and read their history in a nation's eyes, their lot forbade. Nor circumscribed alone their growing virtues, but their crimes confined, forbade to wade through slaughter to a throne, and shut the gates of mercy on mankind. The struggling pangs of conscious truth to hide, to quench the blushes of ingenuous shame, or heap the shrine of luxury and pride with incense kindled at the muse's flame. Far from the madding crowd's ignoble strife, their sober wishes never learned to stray. Along the cool, sequestered vale of life, they kept the noiseless tenor of their way. For thee, who, mindful of the unhonored dead, dost in these lines their artless tale relate, if chance, by lonely contemplation led, some kindred spirit shall inquire thy fate, haply some hoary-headed swain may say, After we seen him at the peep of dawn, brushing with hasty steps the dews away, to meet the sun upon the upland lawn. There, at the foot of yonder nodding beech that wreathes its old fantastic roots so high, his listless length at noontide would he stretch and pore upon the brook that babbles by. One morn I missed him on the customed hill, along the heath and near his favorite tree. Another came, nor yet beside the rill, nor up the lawn, nor at the wood was he. The next, with dirges due in sad array, slow through the churchway path we saw him borne. Approach and read, for thou canst read, the lay graved on the stone beneath yon aged thorn.
To Michael Redgrave, reading Thomas Gray's elegy written in a country churchyard. And again, the sleeve notes I shall read out for this. Thomas Gray wrote very little, yet the elegy, inspired by the death of a schoolfellow, is included in every anthology of English poetry. It is truly amazing that this one poem has contributed so much to the imagery of our language. So I'm going to return now for the next couple of excerpts from this same interview from 1961, conducted by Lansdowne Recordings with Aldous Huxley, and he's talking about Victorian social consciousness. And I've never actually been able to get in to see it, but he mentions The Mummy of Jeremy Bentham, which I keep meaning to go and have a look at in London. But one of these days, I'm sure I'll have an opportunity.
Don't you think that by the 19th century, by Victorian times, although there was all this injustice and horror, there was a beginning of social consciousness? There's a considerable drive towards amelioration of social conditions, and a lot of reforms took place.
I remember years ago going to look at the mummy of Jeremy Bentham at the top of the big staircase in University College in Gower Street, going with Schweitzer to see it. And one opens the door, and there sits this sweet little old gentleman with, he has a wax face and his silvery hair which falls over his shoulder, and a bottle green swallowtail coat with brass buttons and striped cotton trousers and varnished pumps, smiling at one. And Schweitzer looked at him for some time and said, "Oh, I'm always so very, very fond of Jeremy Bentham. He's one of the few philosophers whose doctrines never did any harm, but on the whole did nothing but good." I thought this was a very interesting thing, and he said, "Oh, compare him with Hegel, for example," and sort of shook his head in despair. And it is quite true that if the tree is known by its fruits, well then, the Benthamism is infinitely to be preferred to Hegelianism, which gave us Marxism and Prussianism and all kinds of horrors. Whereas Bentham gave us Chadwick and decent sewage systems and proper municipal government and things like that, all of which are wholly to the good.
Surely Zen is just the kind of inward turning which makes for cushioning an otherwise intolerable existence.
But Zen isn't really all inward turning. I mean, it's outward turning in some ways. I mean, it's both inward and outward. It's after all, nobody's been more acutely aware of landscapes, of flowers, of birds than the Chinese artists. And this does represent a whole, and Japanese artists too, represent a whole social attitude towards the external world of seeing infinity in a grain of sand. I mean, this the Blake poem exactly sums up what they were after and what they so consummately succeeded in doing. I mean, this is simultaneously outward and inward, which seems to me the most desirable state you can possibly have. The Japanese landscape art was 200 years later than the Song landscape art, which was the early expression of Zen in the Far East and the expression of Buddhism. They have their religion in Shintoism. They have various Buddhist sects which are full of ritual and symbols and so on. But they do have, and there is a certain element of this in Christianity too, this idea of a non-dogmatic, non-symbolic, I wouldn't call it religion, I'd just call it an approach to the universe. I mean, they're not worshipping anybody particularly, but they're just, this is the way they want to respond to the universe with the maximum of sensibility, with the greatest perception of the sort of the mystery within the explained and understood world. I mean, again, this is making the best of both worlds, to understand as much as you can and to label and to classify, but at the same time, behind the labels, to perceive the fathomless mystery of existence, which is the whole essence of Zen, it seems to me. And in this respect, I feel that this approach to the fathomless mystery is far better than the, say, the Vedanta or the Hinayana Buddhist approach, which consists of this contemplation, which is intense concentration, therefore almost universal exclusion of everything. I mean, the whole point of the later Mahayana doctrine is that it includes things. I mean, it permits you to live in the world, but perceiving the absolute, perceiving nirvana, not outside the world, as the arhat does in the Hinayana tradition, but perceiving it within it and realizing it in acts of work and love. I mean, I don't know any higher ideal of life than that. I mean, it seems to touch on every level, on the ethical, the philosophic, the artistic.
Now, this next recording is, again, another little excerpt of Krishnamurti speaking in India from last week, and it combines my interest in recording and field recordings, wildlife, the spoken word. The delivery is just incredible. The pauses, the length of pauses are audacious. His rhythm is out of this world. So, Krishnamurti.
There is maturity, not in terms of time and evolution, but maturity that comes when there is this act of learning. It's only a mature mind that can listen, be very attentive, and have a quiet mind. It's the immature mind that believes, that says this is right and wrong, and pursue something illogical. So, we're going to learn together about action.
And that was a wonderful recording from India there, Krishnamurti speaking. You have been listening to Sean Williams presenting Voice on Record on Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. You can get in touch if you like, any sort of suggestions or comments or questions. You can send an email to voiceonrecord@gmail.com, voiceonrecord@gmail.com, and I shall do my best to reply as quickly as I can. Next week's show is slated to be about India, and I will do my best to present that, and so apologies for the people that missed out on the Irish show, and I've just got time to leave you with a short bit of Shakespeare read by the inimitable Richard Burton. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show.
Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and they melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a wreck behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.